Tonight's episode will be recorded all in one take, so settle in and ignore part of it.
So did everybody enjoy their little summer hiatus?
Yeah. Now, we're recording on the summer solstice, which means that...
First day of summer, right?
It's first day of summer. It's the longest day of the year.
Well, and, but you get what he's saying, right, though? I mean, it's been hot.
Well, and we had, what, 3 weeks off?
We had 3 weeks off.
We had a little bit of time off. Yeah, I think we all took long, luxurious vacations.
I thought you were going to say long, luxurious bubble bath.
I ran out of my house and, like, threw my notebook in the air and just let it go all over the
school's
lawn.
School's out forever. Yeah.
I don't know.
That's good.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Boy. But yeah, I had a nice little bit off for the most part.
Speaking of Alice Cooper... Because that comes out of my mouth a lot of times. Mm-hmm. I saw, like, you know, in his old age, like, he still has that long hair, but he has it, like, pulled back in, like, this stupid ponytail, and he has, like, a Make America Great Again cap on, and he's, like, playing golf. That's all he does.
He's big into golf, but he does have the world's best song about necrophilia, Cold Ethel.
Oh, yeah.
Introduced me to that. Welcome to My Nightmare, I believe was the record.
I know, Welcome to My Nightmare song. Anyway. Alice
We're
Cooper.
Here to talk
Why
about
Why haven't we ever done
different?
An Alice Cooper?
I don't know, record. But I think we should. Like, that's kind of, that got
can.
Me to thinking. Yeah,
yeah.
We should.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just saying, up till now, I mean, it seems ripe for, I don't know.
Ripe for the picking?
Discussion.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's do some theme music. So, I'm Shane.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Mark.
Somebody likes it.
So folks are retiring from things.
Very similar high-profile entertainment retirements in the last...
Well, I know that when I was a kid, I had a buddy who played drums, and he thought Peter Criss was the worst drummer he'd ever heard. I couldn't really tell on those Kiss records or whatever.
Apparently, he's
retiring from touring.
Well,
the lowest level of music industry news.
Especially if you're Peter Criss and you don't. I'm sure his band is like Peter Criss's all-star superstar Kiss, and they all like have. Like
they play
makeup
like
on
county fairs.
Yeah, but they have like makeup on that like somewhat resembles Kiss, but you know not
but
enough
it has to be
get
just different enough to
trademark infringement. Yeah.
At his age, it's like mostly the audience that has makeup on, and his makeup is mostly for shading.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah,
and Daniel Day-Lewis is retiring from acting.
So, yeah. So, like I said in the top of this, like very similar.
Yeah.
Entertainment styles.
If you're in the public eye once every 4 years, you don't have to make an announcement. Just stop. Like,
well,
that's really
no
all
longer
you have
be
to do.
Drinking the milkshake. Apparently, are you not getting this reference?
No.
Shane's looking at me like a dog being shown a card trick.
Yeah, I don't know what you're. Yeah,
it's,
what are you talking
There
about?
Will Be Blood.
I didn't see that movie.
No.
I don't know why.
You should.
Oh yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, no. Anyway, is Peter Criss in that?
I believe he was.
I think the world would be
just
a better.
Just wearing like full-on Kiss makeup, like for no really good reason either.
He's in every scene.
Wandered through the set. Yeah,
and they liked it, so they didn't cut him out. Now I tell you that if you substituted, you know, put Daniel Day-Lewis up behind the drums and then Peter Criss in full makeup.
I'll bet like Daniel Day-Lewis behind the drum kit would be better than Peter Criss on the silver screen.
Well, the best part about that would be like to not...
Or on the drum kit. He's not very good.
The best part would be to not make the movie, but to tell Daniel Day-Lewis that you're making the movie, and he would stay in character as Peter Criss for like weeks on end.
Dude, you're blowing my mind.
That's how that
here.
Shit happens. That's right.
Yeah. What are we here to talk about today, gentlemen?
Billie Holiday.
Similarly.
Lady in Satin. Which was the last album she recorded. I thought it was her second. I didn't want to particularly pick her last album just because.
You did.
I did. And I guess it's somewhat fitting because it's.
This is our last show?
No. Because what I wanted to talk about was the decline of her and vocals and how a once brilliant, shining star like slowly condensed.
Well, at some point you're gonna want to play something from earlier because
yeah,
I don't think she sounds like crap.
No, I think she sounds great, and so that's something I wanted to. This album is so incredibly depressing.
What's it called again?
It's called Lady in Satin.
Lady in Satin.
Yeah, and this is one of the. I'm normally loath to do this on the show. Is to if we have somebody that's like an outsized personality, you know, a la Frank Sinatra. We ended up talking the whole show about Frank Sinatra and very little about the record. I want to talk about this record quite a bit, but dude, there is so much to unpack in this woman's life. I mean, it's just unbelievable from start to finish, like how many sad, horrible things happened to her. I mean, and then she, you know, she apparently, I mean, I've heard some outtakes of her in the 40s where she's like, she's singing great on the recording, and then she'll forget the song, and then she can't talk. She's so fucked up, and she's like yelling and being abusive to everybody.
She was like a massive alcoholic and
heroin addict.
Heroin. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Yeah, she died from cirrhosis. But, yeah, I mean, there was... Okay, so, yeah, so what I want to do, when we do the, normally, those of you that listen to this show, we listen to three songs. As we talk about the record at various points on the show, we'll listen to a song. And on this first break, I want to play part of one of her songs when she's at the highlight of her gift and when she's at the end of her life, which... She sounds good.
Yeah, like when you told me that, you know, this record is known for her kind of being like on the downslope, or, you know, I went back and listened to it again, and you can kind of hear it, but I don't have like the whole perspective of knowing.
No, you like so I think that, I mean, here's the thing. I think that I think it's easy to make the distinction that. That she was on the downslope of her career. I mean, obviously, like, she was dead within a year after this record was recorded. But the, but beyond that, like, the thing that, that really made her a singular talent was, and, you know, a lot of what gets talked about is that her vocal range was not as great as some of her contemporaries.
Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah, Ella Fitzgerald's a notable, like, notably the one that she gets compared to a lot. And but her phrasing was so singular,
it
like that it really elevated her craft.
It is completely singular. There's nobody that, that ever played with meter like she did, except maybe years later. And bear with me because
Ryan.
This is true. Yeah. Not Ryan. Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson.
Oh, that's a fair
if
point.
If you listen to Willie Nelson, he sounds like
you're such an Austinite.
What? No, he does. No, I'm saying that as a person that enjoys music, it took me a long time because Willie Nelson is...
You know who can lift 500 pounds over his head?
Willie Nelson. Hey, you know who can drink 14 gallons of eggs all in one standing? Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson is like the Chuck Norris of this town. But
that's
like,
not a bad idea. We should all come up with like Willie Nelson jokes.
But to your, like, more seriously, like, to where you're going with that, Shane, like, I absolutely agree with you. Like, I think that that's, he... Very singular delivery styles.
Yeah, and like, it, they're off. You know, nobody before Billie Holiday that I was ever aware of. I mean, you sang on the beat, you know, on the beat. She's like if you took a rubber band and just and did this to it.
She's all over the place.
She's all over the place.
But it still
Shane
kinda
is
works.
Stretching an imaginary rubber band.
Stretching an imaginary rubber band. Yeah. But yeah, and that's the thing. She doesn't do that as much on this record. And I think the reason why is because I don't think she knew the songs very well. But the ones that she had sung before, there's one, I Get Along Without You Very Well, she had sung before, and that's the one on the record where you see her the most, like, doing the Billie Holiday thing.
You but
know?
She also, to your, like, kind of where you were going with that, it's like, in terms of being, like, playing with the tempo and being ahead or behind the beat,
the meter.
Like, yeah. she knows that she... Like,
she's got
to
get
that's,
there eventually.
Well, she knows that that's been her signature and one of the things that she's been able to do successfully throughout her career. So it's like in this last record, like she knows that she's still got that. Like it doesn't matter how her voice sounds. She can still play with that convention.
Well, that's part of the reason. So not to to say something in addition to that, part of the reason I like this record, and it, but there's a couple of things that I really enjoyed about it. Number one, this is possibly the most depressing record that we've covered.
Dude, it's really pretty, but if you listen to the words,
yeah.
Holy shit.
Well, it's beautiful. It's lush. Like yeah. it's this contrast between this lushness and this 44-year-old woman who sounds like she's 80, you know, that's basically lost everything in her entire life, singing these really sad songs about losing love, or I'm a fool to want you, or you know, like there's. I mean, it's a good record, but it's somewhat painful. Not as painful, but kind of similar as to the last album that Johnny Cash did, like the fragility
in
his voice. Like,
yeah, well, he sounds like he's on his deathbed.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, she does, you know, but
not in the same way. Like,
it's not in the same way, and I never heard some of the earlier shit that she did. You know, I still would have loved this. It's just completely different. She seems, you know, she has three distinct periods in her life, like in her professional career. They're the 30s, 40s, and the 50s. You know, the 30s, she was like in singing in big bands.
This came out in what, like 58?
59.
59.
Yeah. Literally like 6 months before she died. Or I don't know if she sang, recorded in 59, but in the 30s, she was singing in big bands, doing lots of drugs, fucking lots of dudes, and not getting along with anybody. And then in the 40s,
except those dudes, apparently.
Yeah. Well, briefly, apparently she was
not 15 minutes.
Apparently she did not have a good head for men. You know, they we'll just say that.
I did. Oh, go ahead.
Well, in the 40s, then she sang "God Bless the Child," and that turned her into an international superstar, which she couldn't hold on to because then she was arrested and thrown in prison in the height of her career. And then after, you know, toward the end of the 40s. They took away her New York Cabaret Club card, which allowed you to sing in places that sold alcohol, which were the highest paying places like in America. So she lost like 90% of her income, and she just blew it all on alcohol and heroin. And then in the 50s, you get the stuff like this, where her voice is completely gone downhill. She was still touring and still had a name for herself, but it's so... sad. It's
tragic.
Sad. It's tragic. Oh, man, we haven't even gotten into her early life, but...
Well, we're going to talk about music. That was your caveat. So why don't you...
No, but I do want to talk... I want to talk about... When we come back after the first time we do a break, I want to talk a little bit. That's what I was saying. Normally, I don't want to do that, but there's so much in this woman's life that I definitely think that it should be addressed. Not the least of which... it's a crazy look. I'm looking at the cover. Like, if you listen to the cover of this album, if you listen to her sing, she sounds like she's in her 70s.
Well, why don't you pick a song for us to
Oh,
experience?
Okay. So, first off, I want to listen to an older song, which I want to, I think probably my favorite is I'll Be Seeing Her version of I'll Be Seeing You that came out in 44. And then. After that, we could listen to Maybe I'm a Fool to Want You. That's a pretty sad one. There's a couple on here that aren't as sad. They're a little more, not whimsical, but not as like, she's just been beaten and left.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places. That this heart of mine embraces all day through. I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true, a love that's there for others too. I'm a fool.
Two different singers.
I mean, yeah, but even the one that's messed up, it's like, it's flavoring. I mean,
no,
like,
it's great. I'm not saying it's bad music. What I'm saying is,
she sounds beaten down. She sounds like the old lady, like, sitting around the corner smoking an impossibly long cigarette like she has every day for the last 50 years.
Right, and she's 43 at the time, I think, that she recorded that song.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you listen to the older... And, like, a lot of the... it sounds... It's beautiful. I love her older music. I love the stuff off this record just because of the fragility and the... She has great mic technique still. I mean, she does a really good close-up there.
Well, like, even if, you know, if you juxtapose it and realize that, you know, she sounds weathered and beaten down, she's still better than all the rest of us.
She's still better than 99.9% of any singers, man. I mean, but.
I think the thing that really elevates her work as opposed to the work even of some other accomplished jazz singers is that she always had a really keen sense of self. Like, she didn't waver on who she wanted to be. Now, I know that probably differs a little bit from some of what you're saying, Shane, in terms of her confidence as she gets older, but like, she had a perspective. Like, she was like, okay, this is who I am and what I'm going to try and do. Now, her grasp of like how much he could command that variant.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, how much he could command it. I mean, there's definitely, you don't come out as a singer and try the shit that she's doing, like especially the stuff that we listen to from the 40s. She's just like, it's almost like watching somebody like fall over and they're just about to tip and then they come right back up and you're like, what the fuck? You know, like somebody really drunk. I'm sure you've all seen things like that.
I've never seen a drunk person.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, that's true. I'm sure you haven't.
I mean, no. I don't know if this is just, a symptom of the advancement in music or the way that they recorded, the way that they mixed. But what I noticed about it is that early recording, she's way up front in the mix.
Well, it's definitely
that. And I don't know if part of that is that they wanted to feature her voice more, and then in these later recordings, they're kind of like, she needs support. Let's bring these strings
up.
Apparently, she
has like a 40-piece orchestra behind her on this.
I think it's a lot of that. Like, she needed the support. Like, she's real up front in that second mix, too. But I think, it's possibly both of the things that you just said. I mean, like, definitely advances in recording were happening.
And it's the ego of the artist. Like, you know what it is? Like, she's not going to let them bury her. And then at the same time, it's probably also the era that it was recorded in, right? Which is to say, there are certain types of songs, like with big orchestral movements
that
work.
Had listened to Frank Sinatra's In the Wee Small Hours, which is, of all the records that we've covered, I was like, well, this is obviously the closest one.
There's at least one song on this record that's on In the Wee Small Hours.
It's interesting to me, Ryan, that you guys bring that up, because I found myself kind of contrasting, not just because we've covered In the Wee Small Hours on this podcast, but like I found myself contrasting those two, because Sinatra always brought bravado, but she, in some ways, even though she has a firmness of perspective, I feel like she brings like a certain
fragility,
vulnerability.
Yeah,
definitely
both of those things. Yeah, and they somewhat, the orchestration sounds somewhat similar, similar song choices. They came out like right at the same time.
I think he used Nelson Riddle.
He did use Nelson Riddle, but I'm saying like the same similar like big orchestra with trombone and.
Well,
like,
and that's the one part that stuck out. I guess it's J.J. Johnson was a guy's name who is not the same J.J. Johnson who was the early MTV era,
or not the same J.J. Johnson that plays drums for Chadesky and Trucks.
I did not know about that one, but anyway,
he's an Austin drummer.
There's muted trombone throughout this thing, and it sounds awesome.
I love it. I think that this is what I was going to say that you brought up in Waste My Hour. It's like, I love this record more than that record, a lot more, actually. I love the arrangements. I like the sound of it. But there's some really good choices. The muted trombone, everything just sounds, it's a good sounding record.
So are these, did she write at all? Like, or is this,
no,
they're like basically of the era, just pick stuff from the, Brill Building or whatever.
She didn't, as far as I know, she never did any writing. But nobody really did.
Nobody
did.
It wasn't
expected of her. No. Yeah.
I mean, you would see like blues guys did, but like not in the pop world or stuff like this with jazz.
Well, and there was a whole, there was that whole undercurrent of dudes who just made a living writing for other people, which obviously still happens today, but it's different.
They go to work in their suits with their briefcase and go write music.
Right? In Tin Pan Alley, man. Yeah, Tin Pan Alley, like all that stuff. This is a whole different world. You know what? That world went away. I think I've talked
Beatles.
About this. The Beatles.
Beatles did it.
The Beatles single-handedly put hundreds of professional songwriters out of work. Because think about it now. Who uses professional songwriters? If pretty much...
I don't know. Ad agencies?
Pop singers. Pop singers. Justin Bieber.
Sweden.
In hip-hop. In country. Yeah. Country music. But, You don't see it like...
But it was a very distinct thing. These people write music. These people perform it. And never the twain shall meet.
Well, it always used to really get on my nerves, and people would say, you don't really run into it as much when you're out of your 20s, but to some degree they're like, oh, fuck that dude. He doesn't write his own songs. Well, neither did Elvis.
Who cares?
Or Frank Sinatra or Billie Holiday or Ella Fitzgerald or Louis Armstrong or, Like, it's just such a weird... But you know what I'm talking about.
I remember when I was in college, this girl was shitting on the Pixies because they did a cover. And I was like, fucking get over yourself. Yeah, they did a cover.
Christ.
Jesus and Mary Chain song. And I was like, so what?
It's a really misplaced concern. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
why?
She was like 20. So.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You don't really run into that as much when you're out of your 20s, but as you did like back then.
Hey, before we listen to another one, we probably should. I just want to read. One of the things I really love doing is checking Twitter for official accounts of like people like Billie Holiday who've been dead for 70 years or whatever. And it always leads you to
what?
Like, no, it's true. Like there are official
She's
accounts
been dead
that
60 years.
Well,
Kevin.
I'm sorry. Like anyway, the point being like that she would have an active like current social media account and on that medium is kind of hilarious. And anyway, what it does though is if you search for that stuff, it brings up all of these like anybody else who tweets anything that is related to that particular person. And anyway, I feel like there's probably a lot of stuff with Billie Holiday that pops up that reads a lot like this guy, which he's like, I know no one's life is actually a movie, but they're playing Billie Holiday while I sit alone drinking wine over and I was like, yeah, that's probably like that's the story. But I can like even as sad as it is, like to where you were going, Shane, like I can listen to Billie Holiday under any circumstance.
Yeah, me
and it
too.
Just pleases me to no end.
I find her the same way. And part of that is just because like there's moods that are set, but just because she's such a singular talent, like regardless of what point in her career she's in. So, I don't know. You guys want to do another one of these?
Let's do another one.
All right. I'll listen to this one. It's a little more whimsical.
There's whimsy on this record?
You didn't get let me get my hand up to do my air quotes. It's but
stunt whimsy.
But it's... Okay, so the song that we listened to, like...
that band.
Wait, stunt whimsy?
Yeah.
That's a good
it's, not the, it's just the fill-in whimsy.
I just, as soon as you said that, for some reason, like the opening to The Fall Guy just popped in my head. I don't know why. Because he was a stuntman? I don't know. You guys remember that show, The Fall Guy?
Yeah, like he like skids across a car.
Yeah, that's that's all I remember. That's actually the only thing I remember about that opening montage.
Anyway.
Okay, so we listened to I'm a Fool to Want You, and there's a lot of these... That just sounds like a woman that is a bit like... That is in love with the man that gets drunk and beats her up. I mean, that's pretty much how her voice sounds on this record too. And there's You Don't Know What Love Is. There's a lot of songs like that on here that are just irredeemable. You know, the characters in them, but beautiful. I think is almost there's almost a redeemable part of it. It's sad. It's very sad and heartbreaking in every way. But
so which one are we listening to?
But Beautiful.
All right.
Love is funny, oh, it's sad. It's quiet, oh, it's mad. It's a good thing, oh, it's bad. But beautiful. Beautiful to take a chance, and if you fall, you fall. And I'm thinking I wouldn't mind at all.
So right around the turn of the millennium, there was a really great NPR interview between Murray Horowitz of the American Film Institute and A.B. Spellman of the National Endowment for the Arts. And one of the questions that Horowitz asked Spellman, and they talked specifically about this record and her later career. And one of the questions that was asked of Spellman was like, how did she choose her repertoire for this album? And Spellman said she chose her repertoire on the basis of the lyrics. She wanted to do songs that she hadn't done before. And so she and Ray Ellis, who was the arranger on this record, and her lawyer went down to the Colony record store and thumped through the sheet music. And Billy read the lyrics. She never did learn how to read music. And she picked out the lyrics that she enjoyed the most, the ones that she thought she could do the best job with, and that's how the record was chosen.
Makes sense. I mean, because if you didn't know that she didn't write, I mean, there was a theme throughout.
Well, yeah. Also, it's kind of even makes it even... puts a little more tragic dust on the top of that. Because
tragic dust.
Because because, you know, every song on there is a ball-bustingly sad. So it just kind of shows you where her head was at that time, you know?
I think Gilbert O'Sullivan is a big Billie Holiday fan.
Probably of this particular record. This is probably like when he was writing Alone Again Naturally, whenever he took his breaks, he would put on some of this old Billie Holiday.
Get inspired.
Every draft he would be like, okay, is it sad enough yet? And then listen to this record. Nope.
Let's go back.
Gotta dial up the blues.
Yeah, I mean, pretty song, but if you dig into the lyrics, man.
Well, and that one of the reasons I like that song is like that she's very expressive with her emotions. Like when she's smiling, you can see she's smiling.
You can hear it in her voice. She has like kind of an Eartha Kitt kind of quality too.
Well, in these later recordings, she does. Like I definitely hear the Eartha Kitt stuff all over it. It's another young woman that sounded that like she was a lot older.
Well, I listened to this this week and went back and listened to some Etta James, and I got to fall on the side of the Etta James. Like, not that they're necessarily the same thing, like you brought up a few weeks ago or a couple months ago, you know, that Billie Holiday, you know, be in the conversation for like best female vocalist of the 20th century.
Yes.
I went back and listened to Etta James, and I'm like, man, like, and maybe it's just because she was at such a nadir at this point, Billie Holiday was. Mm-hmm. But when I went back and listened to Etta James, I'm like, man, I gotta go with her.
Well, Etta James is great, but again, I think that for the best female vocalist of the century, I'd put the middle part of her career over this. I mean, like I said before, they're essentially two different singers. I mean, she's singing
sure.
Completely
so I wrote myself a note. I wrote Billie Holiday is to Frank Sinatra as Etta James is to Otis Redding.
That's kind of a fair statement. I see what you're saying. They both played with phrasing in a similar ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I don't think Sinatra would have been Sinatra. He's another one, like just like Willie Nelson. So yeah, that's the triumvirate.
It all comes back to Willie.
Hey, Willie Nelson. Hey, you know who can drink 100 pounds of jelly beans and still run 50 miles?
Willie Nelson.
Yeah, but I mean, I hear
100 pounds of jelly beans.
He drinks them too.
You know, like, I just can't even do the math.
What I'm
like,
trying to figure out here is I'm trying to like think of stuff that doesn't make any sense at all. Like Willie Nelson.
Yeah, he's our Paul Bunyan of Austin.
The Paul Bunyan of Austin, except instead of like having like an axe over his shoulder, he's like holding a bong.
Yeah, are we talking?
Yeah, he's got a giant joint over his shoulder. Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, boys.
Time for the intermission?
Yeah, let's do an intermission.
Hey, kids. So,
why do you turn into Bozo the Clown every now and again?
I don't know. Whatever. And don't sass me, Ryan. I'll sass you all I want. Okay.
Whoa.
Okay.
Calm down, boys.
All right. But
we're going to come to head thumps.
Hey. That's funny. Anyway, I was telling you not to sass me because the middle segment today, a few minutes with, is some AM Gold. So I was like, if you'll just shut the fuck up and let me get there, we'll put you in a happy place. So today's middle segment is brought to you by Robbie Dupree and Steal Away.
I know that song.
I don't know that song.
I thought it was the Doobie Brothers.
I think
though.
You're just making it up. Right
no, now. No. There's a little bit of Michael McDonald in there, but we'll talk about that on the other side.
Show me what I want to
Robbie Dupree. That was his song from his 1980 debut album, also called Robbie Dupree.
Well, and that was apparently his introduction to the stage at Perfect 10 or something. Robbie Dupree, everybody, on the main stage.
Robbie Dupree from his
Welcome to the Stage. Away. Yeah, no, yeah.
Tip your bartenders.
Anyway, that song peaked at number 6. If you get a chance, there are lots of versions of Steal Away on the YouTubes. But if you could find the one that's
American
hit,
Bandstand
version? American Bandstand version, it's pretty great.
That like, shit is so awkward to me because they're so obviously awkward. Not playing like it's a they're you know just
lip syncing. Stuff.
Yeah,
but so it just took me to like a couple things. If you're the percussionist. Yeah. Like, you have to act like you're playing, but not really hit skins?
I think they do hit it. I think for the people that are there, I think the music is so loud in the studio that they don't notice it. Like,
okay, yeah, that's the other thing I was going to think. Like, you know, if you're, you know, a dancer
right.
Or audience member at this point, like, do you just hear the kind of awkward non-playing?
Yeah, you just it's just like one guy, like, doon, 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 doon.
Dude, yeah, dude. I mean, if you're
and
like...
I guarantee you the music had to have been turned up really loud. Like,
to where you think people in the audience actually thought they were playing?
I don't think I don't know if they thought they were playing, but they, you know, they American Bandstand...
But it's weird. It's just
they
it's
would
musical
dance to
pantomime.
That stuff.
And he'd it come is, up and, you know, Dick Clark would come up and congratulate them on their performance.
It was like Top of the Pops. In England.
England.
Yeah.
This is my favorite part of stuff like this is looking up the Wikipedia entries on this jazz, and it says here, the lyrics suggest a romantic meeting between two lovers. Dupree skillfully asks that they, quote, steal away into the night, knowing that it is wrong yet irresistible.
I do like the song, man.
I do too.
Oh, yeah, no, it's totally.
I was familiar with that song. I haven't heard it as much.
And he does look like Michael McDonald, so I am forgiven for thinking it was.
No,
and then there's a breakdown part where it sounds exactly like the Doobie Brothers.
Yeah,
the song's keyboard arrangement is notably similar to that of the Doobie Brothers' '78 song "What a Fool Believes."
And so when did this come out? This got to be like early 80s.
Yeah, it was a couple of years after
that song. It does sound just like that.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what.
And
it
I
was.
Always
yeah.
thought that that like
the "What a Fool Believes," Kenny.
That's like, what just happened? I always thought that was Michael McDonald singing backup on this track, but I guess not. Like anyway, yeah, it's very much
in
that wheelhouse,
just like that. You know, I love that shit. By the way, like I love songs like that,
just easy breezy.
But
like,
I hate rock and roll from the 70s. I fucking hate it. I don't know why. Like why my brain just goes into two. Different places, but like all that classic rock shit, like I just can't stand it. But give me like a cheesy fucking Candy Dupree song, all about it.
Candy Dupree.
Candy Dupree.
Candy Dupree, ladies and gentlemen.
Give it up for Candy Dupree.
On the pole,
Candy
Dupree. Candy
Dupree.
So gross. I think what we ought to do, hey, you guys, I think we can never swing it. We should do... A soft
just
rock.
Ask if we can all be swingers.
No, stay with me, ass.
Stop talking.
Like I think we should do a. I think we should do a soft rock mixtape from a patio somewhere, with margaritas,
various drinks that require accoutrement,
and my
like various drinks that have bright blue colors in some of them.
Yeah,
and,
I'd be down for that.
And just a swath of shag carpet.
I don't know about the shag carpet part. Like,
I'm down with that. Kevin and I grew up.
I like
well,
it. Just
our,
where do we
the
get
the first
it?
House I remember had really lush, like shag carpeting. It was green shag carpeting.
Yeah,
even better.
Like split pea soup.
Anyway, so that's "Steal Away" by Robbie Dupree. That song charted at number 6 in 1980, and also landed him an awkward beginning to an interview with Dick Clark that never quite makes the YouTube cut. But anyway, Ryan. Since we hadn't recorded in a while, and since you have been
you
a little bit on
this
the mend,
to me.
Yeah, this is that's a heal up.
Yeah, I'm all about
midsection.
It.
Yeah. All right, let's do it. Let's get back into some sad.
So I threatened earlier to read a little bit about her life. It's just a singular.
The word you used a minute ago was Dickensian.
It's Dickensian. Yeah. Here, let me just start, and I'll read you some highlights. And this is granted, this isn't shit you have to dig hard into. This is literally on her Wikipedia page. Okay, she was born Eleonora Fagan. Wait, already we're talking Dickensian. I didn't even think about that.
Fagan?
Yeah. She was the daughter of an unmarried teenage couple. Not long after she was born, her father abandoned the family to pursue a career as a jazz banjo player, and her mom moved to Philly.
Jazz banjo?
Yeah. Well, this is in like 1916.
I know, but I just didn't know
interpreted
that was a
thing. Banjo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, banjo wasn't long for the world of jazz, but yeah. So, anyway, so her mom took what were known as transportation jobs, which were like she was she was working on the railroad all the long day, apparently, and she was raised by some other woman's mother-in-law. So then eventually, it doesn't say who. It just says, like, some woman's
some
mother-in-law.
Lady raised her?
Yeah, so she had no parental guidance, so she would, like, frequently skip school. Oh, and let me explain. She's about 9 at this point when she's, like, getting all these. She's getting arrested for truancy and skipping school. Then she was sent to, like, a Catholic reform school. They paroled her after 9 months. By the age of 11, she had dropped out of school and never went back. So then her mom returned home one day in 1926 to discover a neighbor attempting to rape her. She was 11. They arrested her mom and her and placed them in protective custody.
But not the dude?
No, I guess he was arrested, but it doesn't say what happened to him. And then so eventually her mom ended up moving into a brothel.
As one does.
Yeah. And then the brothel was raided. She became a prostitute at 13, Billie Holiday. Then the brothel was raided. They both spent time in prison. And this is before she's 15 years old. And it never, ever lets up. It's completely relentless. So anyway.
And meanwhile, she made some of the most enduring music of
the
20th century somehow.
I think part of it's got to be you just have to have some sort of like street. She had to have like this streetwise cocksure. You know, she listened to jazz, and so it's inevitable that the only way, like we talked about her, like her vocals earlier, like how it's there are very few people that are able to do what she does, but she kind of sings like a trumpet player if you think about it. Like
I can see that,
you know, in a lot of ways, and so I feel like she was maybe influenced by. You know, trombones, too, like a trombone player, you know,
well,
like sliding.
Yeah, like she kind of slides in and out of her phrasing and the
right.
passages.
Definitely would not have been as popular if she had been influenced by jazz banjo.
It right. would have been amazing, though.
At some point, and not tonight, I want to know what the fuck a jazz banjo sounds like.
Oh, you know, like ding 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 ding.
I know what a banjo sounds like.
No, but like a banjo, you're used to.
Are you doing like Dixieland?
Yeah, like Dixieland. Yeah, like you're strumming it.
Okay.
You fucking have heard that shit, dude.
Anyway, here's a picture. I'm just gonna flash this around. This is a picture of Billie Holiday at the beach in 1932. Like, if that doesn't say, like, there's already a lot of miles here. Like, she's in a bathing suit. It's in Coney Island. She's got a cigarette in her hand. She looks like, oh, this again? Like, yeah, pretty much, like.
Well, she just looks like any other, like, regular woman at a beach to
me. I don't know. She looks like a human callus to me.
I don't know if I would go that far, but, I don't know. It just seems to me that, if that's how, like, the stuff that I just read, if that's how things are starting out for you,
you're probably not going to have
it's like not
a,
surprising
a good
to
prognosis
me.
For the rest of your
no, and you know, and she was black.
Well, I mean, like, one thing that we haven't talked about in particular was like we did touch a little bit on the Tin Pan Alley stuff and like kind of this whole subtext of this whole industry of songwriters, but there are a lot of. You know, one of my favorite jazz artists of the early part of Billie Holiday's life was Fats Waller, and that guy was an amazing songwriter as well as an amazing
Shane is
performer.
A big Fats Waller fan, actually.
Yeah.
We don't have to go
all the way down that road right now. But the point is like the rumors persist to this day that Fats Waller wrote a bunch of songs that he couldn't sell himself because he was a black artist, so he sold them to white guys who could sell them, and then he got a cut of the action. Like, that's
so strange.
Isn't
to
it crazy? Like,
you know, when you look at like Nat King Cole or something, he like had his own show. Like, he'd, you know, be able to like perform in front of like a giant hall of like white people. But oh, by the way, you can't stay here.
Yeah, like, none of it makes sense.
No, none
it's
of it makes
nuts.
Sense.
Yeah, like you're in this, you know, beautiful hotel. All these people are paying money to come watch you, but just as long as you'd sleep somewhere else.
You know who was really good about fighting that stuff, standing up and like kicking people's asses?
Sinatra.
Sinatra was.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. So I mean, there, gonna be hey, there he is right now. Like,
gonna be ring a ding for you, bozos.
Boom.
Yeah. Ring a ding for you, bozos. I forget about all that stuff. So I suggest to everyone that's listening right now that you read a piece. It's in Politico magazine. It's called The Hunting of Billie Holiday. And it's about this dude, Henry Anslinger, who later became the head of what would become the DEA. But during his pursuit of Billie Holiday, he was running what at the time was known as the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which is what the Federal Bureau of Prohibition became. And once Prohibition was gone,
it eventually became the DEA.
It eventually did, but yeah. But at the time, like you know, none of this stuff was illegal, and so it was going away, and like the Bureau of Narcotics was going away. So, but I just want to read you the first, just real quick, read you the first paragraph in this piece. It's fascinating, and well, I'll read you the paragraph, and I'll tell you a little bit about at the end. It says jazz was the opposite of everything Harry Anslinger believed in. Improvised, relaxed, freeform, it follows its own rhythm. Worst of all, it is a mongrel music made up of European, Caribbean, and African echoes, all mating on American shores. To Anslinger, this is musical anarchy and evidence of a recurrence of the primitive impulses that lurk in black people waiting to emerge. Quote, it sounded, his internal memo said, like jungles in the dead of night. The racist motherfucker.
Yeah, that's all just undercurrent of racism right there.
Yeah, completely. But this guy was a piece of shit. He was instrumental in getting marijuana made illegal, and he blamed it. He said it was a race drug. He blamed it on the Mexicans coming across the border and jazz musicians. And yeah, later he ended up running the DEA. And this article is fascinating, but one of the things that's super depressing is that she was on her deathbed.
She got arrested while dying, right?
Yeah, he arrested her and handcuffed her to the bed while she was dying from cirrhosis.
And had, what, 70 cents in her?
She had 70 cents in her bank account. Yeah, it's fucking crazy. This woman's life is just, no wonder she picked a bunch of fucking sad songs. It sounded like she was 80 when she was 40.
Well, I mean, you gotta think, like, maybe death was preferable at that point.
I certainly think that dying of cirrhosis wasn't the worst thing that happened to her in her life.
No. you know, probably like she was relieved to finally be getting to the...
I don't know. Get to the promised land.
Yeah. Shane, you want to play another song?
Sure, we could do another song. Let's do I Get Along Without You Very Well.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do, except when soft rains fall and drips from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do, but I get along without you.
The All Music review of this record said, this is Billie Holiday's penultimate album, recorded when her body was telling her enough was enough. During the sessions with arranger Ray Ellis, she was drinking vodka neat as if it were tap water. Despite her ravaged voice, the sweetness had long gone. She was still an incredible singer. The feeling and tension she manages to put into almost every track set this album as one of her finest achievements. You've Changed and I Get Along Without You Very Well are high art performances from the singer who saw life from the bottom up. Interesting perspective.
Life from the bottom up. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love this song.
I do too.
This performance. I mean, yeah, she does sound a little raggedy, but like still.
Well,
like,
but she's really got that thing. Like you can see the snap come back, the sparkle, like that sort of like fluidity working within like meter that she had when she was younger. But I wonder. I love that song a lot. It's a Hoagie Carmichael song, and my favorite version of that song prior to this is definitely the Chet Baker version. And Sinatra also records this on In the Wee Small Hours, which are both versions. Sinatra's another, you know, Chet Baker was a trumpet player, and Sinatra was a singer that kind of had that same kind of trumpet player sound to the way that he did his meter, like Billie Holiday did. I wonder if she's familiar with those versions, and that's kind of why she's playing.
Well, she definitely was familiar with Sinatra's version of it. Cause
yeah, but I'm wondering, like, Chet Baker's version came out just a couple years before she recorded this, so I'm wondering if she heard that, because, you know, again, like I was saying before, she sounds sort of like a trumpet player.
Well, and this has that muted trombone on it, like just the, like, mellifluous muted trombone. Trombone's a weird instrument. It can sound like a fucking frog. Yeah. But if you do it the right way, and particularly if you mute it, it can be really pretty.
Oh, I love that shit, man. I listen to quite a bit of it. Hey, can I just say one thing? I was just reading up on the history of the song because I wanted to see what year that Chet Baker recording came out. And there was a recording of the song by the Daruti Column, which is a band you guys probably have never heard of, but
I have not.
The guitar player went on to like play on Morrissey's solo record, and they were
and
like,
and there he is.
They were like,
we got almost to the end.
They were almost like, to the end of the show.
I did that just for Kevin.
Yeah, thanks.
I did that.
That's that slamming sound you hear is my forehead on the keyboard in front of me.
Oh,
anyway,
I just had to once I saw it.
Long tail on that kite.
What was your point?
Oh, I know. I really was just into fuck with Kevin.
Oh, good.
Anyway, I think
because Kevin says that either you or I have to mention Morrissey show
and or the Smiths, show
constantly because really we're talking about Billie Holiday, and why wouldn't there be a Morrissey reference?
Well, you just got one.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess like the songs are sad.
Anyway,
yeah,
etc. So
she was rocking the pompadour.
No, the last thing that I was going to mention about Billie Holiday, and I think that we haven't really talked about this, but. Well, in great detail, but I think when you're talking about her legacy and sort of, you know, we've gone on and on about how tragic the life was and all the things that happened, and certainly that's certainly true, but I think I mentioned earlier the firmness of her, like how sure of who she was as a singer she was during her lifetime, but I also think it's one of those deals where like. That's a deal where, like, she had a Mark Twain situation, right, where she was famous in her lifetime and realized her gift in her lifetime, and the people around her responded to her gift in her lifetime, and that changes the way that you respond to the world. So I hear that in this record. It's like when all the, like, when the gift starts to fray away, but all you've ever known is this adoration, like, you still know how to step up to the mic and bring it.
Was it Sunset Boulevard, where it's like Betty Davis was like,
no,
you know,
it's Gloria Swanson.
Okay.
Or, I mean, it's Sunset Boulevard's Gloria Swanson.
Okay. But like where, you know, like you've lived past your former glory and you have 70 cents in the bank. Man, I don't know. I think fame is fascinating.
But fleeting.
And fleeting. I'd rather not have it. I mean, by the way, tell all your friends to listen to this show, because I want that kind of fame.
Ryan, you can also listen to Ryan's Under the Rock podcast.
Yeah, but, man, just like where, you know, you couldn't walk down a street, like, that just no thank you. And to, like, grasp onto it and believe that that's your whole worth as a person or whatever, I don't know. Like, to me, it's just bizarre.
Well, and we were talking about earlier, if you start from the bottom up and you know chaos from the very beginning and this is your way out of it, like you sort of grab it by the throat. So
yeah,
anyway,
I suppose
like,
it, yeah.
She definitely grabbed life by the throat. And you sometimes know. I have a feeling from what I've read that her husbands and boyfriends grabbed her by the throat. But
sounds like it.
It's a very complicated life.
But I love Billie Holiday and I'm really pleased that you chose this record, Shane.
Oh, yeah, me too. I love her. I think at some point somebody, we rarely do this, but one of us should pick one of her mid-career records just to hear like the contrast between the two styles.
That sounds like a good plan.
Okie dokie. So, Ryan, what you got?
Okie dokie. So, At the Drive-In has reconvened 20 years on or whatever it's been.
You ever been to a drive-in?
I have been to a drive-in.
It's fun.
Were they all seeing the same movie? They were like, oh, hey, maybe we should get the band back together?
Me and my friend when I was in high school, Doug Gilman, brought our girlfriends to a drive-in, and we drank wine coolers and like made out with our girlfriends and barely watched the movie.
That sounds awesome, and it also sounds like shit I would have done in high school.
Yeah. But no, there was a band from El Paso called At the Drive-In, who as soon as they kind of broke big with their song One Arm Scissor, immediately broke up and formed two other bands. But anyway, they have reconvened, and they put out a new song called Metronome Arthritis. And it does have an accompanying video, which we will hear shortly watch. So let's get in.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Maury Povich. Welcome to this special edition of A Current Affair.
I guess I've broken my record of
that one was picking
a new song.
That was good. What was the first time? Was it 8 years?
Something like that. Seven or 8 years.
Because because in this segment, if those of you that listen to the show remember the show, the video.
The final segment is supposed to be a new song.
A Current Affair. It's supposed to have come out within the last 12 months. And that what the first song, when it come out, Ryan? 1999.
So 18 years ago? Turns out that's not a new song, but I was glad we watched it because we were able to juxtapose it with a genuinely new stuff. At the drive-in song called Hostage Stamps, which is what we just watched. And the one thing that is consistent between the two, that band always sounds like a rubber band that's about to break. Like if you stretch it out as far as it could possibly go, their entire career recording together sounds like that.
Yeah,
sure. I'm definitely not the target market for that music.
I'm not necessarily either. They have the odd song here and there that I like.
It's fine. I mean, neither of those songs were bad.
Yeah. There's just a lot of tension filled in their oeuvre.
Yeah, I think like the angry stuff. Like
they do.
Just angers for anger's sake. Like just.
I just wonder how hard that would be. Stuff. Like, you know, recording that at age 22 makes perfect sense. But if you're like, you know, 46...
I will say, I don't think they're 46, but...
I think they're around my age.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, they would have... They're getting close to middle age, we'll say that.
Our friend Marcos, who runs the bar Barflies, mm-hmm. He knows those guys. He's right around our age.
They're all all those Elf House dudes. Yeah, I mean, I thought that the musicianship was definitely a little more complicated on that last song than the first one, but...
I think that's actually... kind of a good thing. Like it just sort of speaks to the fact that they're like still interested in their craft.
Right, they're not
like,
spinning their wheels. No, I'm saying that is it. I thought that was a good thing.
You contrast that with like like that Stone Roses track that popped up after
Jesus.
Years.
Where like, they were just like coasting.
Yeah.
I mean coasting.
It was like it was marketing with like a little bit of song.
There's another
a song to go along with this marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it? Let's all get together and build a wall. Like
I don't know. Yeah, I'm about to
build
that.
It already.
Yeah.
Build it around that song.
So we never listen to it again.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, there was one that came out after that I listened to, and I can't remember if it was better or worse, but the bottom line is neither one of them were very good.
In any case, Hostage Stamps, like, never going to be my favorite song, and they're not long on melody. I did appreciate the Ray Harryhausen-style stop-motion video.
Is that who did all the Tool stuff?
That's a band that I do.
No,
not
Ray
like.
Harryhausen did like all those old like
all
Clash of the Titans.
Oh, right.
All those stop motion things. I thought Tool as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tool, it like kind of has that similar like on the edge kind of thing. But for whatever reason, I like At the Drive-In better than Tool. Neither one of them's ever going to be my favorite band. But they did split into two different factions, and that's going to... Do I have next week? I think I do.
Yeah, you do.
Because I'm picking Uncle Tupelo, No Depression. Mm-hmm. And so they have a similar story.
Dynamic, yeah.
To At the Drive-In.
I will tell you this. Sunvolt and Wilco sound exactly like Mars Volta and Sparta.
Exactly.
You could not get... If two,
any more similar,
any more all similar genre wise, they should.
It'd
yeah,
be a big
piece in the podcast.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. Like so, next week I do want to talk about Uncle Tupelo and their record "No Depression," which I've never heard.
Okay. I have never heard either.
All right,
that's always good. All right, well, just the good old boys, I guess. I don't know.
Never meaning no harm.
Beats all you ever saw.
Been in trouble with the law
since the day we was born.
Till next.
You know who
week?
Else has been in trouble with the law since the day he was born?
Who?
Willie Nelson.
That's true. Well, you know what? My absolute favorite, like, this is a true Willie Nelson story, where, you know, I guess it was about 20 years ago, he, like, got stoned and just decided to pull his Cadillac off to the side of the road in the middle of nowhere in North Texas.
And fell asleep.
And he fell asleep, and he got busted with a joint in the ashtray. And he got arrested. Who the fuck? What kind of...
I remember the quote from it, though. It was like, it was just a roach.
Yeah. What kind of fucking shithead
70-year-old man just goes, it was just a roach.
Yeah, I know, but what I'm saying is, what kind of shithead cop? I mean, that sounds like, hey, boy, what you got in that ashtray from like 1950? I mean, this is in like 2000.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But number one, why did Willie Nelson just decide he had to pull off to the side of the road and take a nap and like love it?
Because he's Willie motherfucking Nelson.
That's right. All right, let's get out of here, guys.
Till next week, I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Shane.
I'm Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.